Hi, I'm Aislinn Antrim with Pharmacy Times. Welcome to Pharmacy Focus Psychedelic Pharmacy, where we take a look at one of the fastest growing markets in healthcare, psychedelic medicine. This month, I had a great conversation with Paul Thielking, Chief Scientific Officer at Cedar Clinical Research by Numinus, who has been doing interesting research into the potential uses of psychedelic medicine in palliative care.
Wonderful. So to start, I've heard a lot about potential uses for psychedelic medicines in mental health, but I haven't heard before about potential uses in palliative care. So can you discuss what led you to this specific area of research?
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk a little bit about that. So first of all, I think talking about the term palliative care is a good starting point. That term has a lot of different connotations for people, and sometimes there's a misunderstanding about what it means. So when I use the word palliative care, I'm really using it in a broad sense to mean that anybody that gets diagnosed with a serious illness, whether it's cancer, whether it's some kind of neurodegenerative disease, whether it's cardiac disease, that palliative care is something that's offered from the time of diagnosis onward. So it's really care that's focused on a person's quality of life and well-being, no matter what stage of illness they're at. So it can be given alongside even curative care for a patient with cancer, let's say. And it's not just limited to end of life care, which is what a lot of people associate with that term palliative care. So palliative care does include late stage disease care and end of life care, but it's not limited to that. So that's one thing to start with. My background is I'm a psychiatrist, but I'm also board certified as a palliative care physician. And I spent most of the past 15 years working in an oncology environment at the cancer hospital at the University of Utah. It's called the Huntsman Cancer Institute, mainly seeing people that were struggling with emotional stress related to having cancer. And my experience was feeling quite limited in our standard approaches to care for people in that situation. For example, with a lot of our anti-depression or anti-anxiety medicines, people often have side effects or they just don't work in many cases. And with talk therapy, which is the other main tool we have in our toolkit, sometimes people just aren't really that interested in talk therapy, or to really get benefits from it requires an extended period of time. And a lot of people that are going through cancer treatment, let's say, they just don't have the luxury of the time that it takes to get to go through that talk therapy process. So I became increasingly interested in this new area of psychedelic medicines over the past few years, especially as the body of research and literature has been building, really seeing it as another option, another kind of tool in our toolkit as those that are trying to help people that are suffering with serious illness. So that's a little bit of the background that led me to being interested in the potential for psychedelics to help anybody that's been diagnosed and is struggling with coping with a serious illness.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Which specific psychedelic medicines have you researched for this use in palliative care, and what have you found?
Yeah. So first of all, just a bit of quick background. So psychedelic medicines were initially being studied back in the 50s and 60s, primarily psilocybin, but also LSD back in those days. And there were two main groups of patients that were receiving the medicines. Number one, people with substance abuse problems, mainly alcohol use disorders. And then the other group was people with cancer. So there's a history that goes back there to the 50s and 60s of patients with cancer being in studies of LSD and psilocybin to help with cancer-related emotional distress. The research basically went on hiatus for several decades, starting in 1970, because all these medicines became Schedule I as part of the Controlled Substances Act. And then just in this past decade, there's been a resurgence of interest. So most of the recent research has been done on psilocybin, which is more maybe commonly termed magic mushrooms. And specifically in around 2015, there were a couple studies, one that came out of Johns Hopkins and one out of NYU, looking at psilocybin for cancer patients with depression and finding significant benefit there for both depression and anxiety symptoms and also quality of life. LSD is also, I think, coming along now with some of the research studies. But for me personally, in terms of my work as a researcher, I've only been fortunate enough to be involved in psilocybin studies up to this point. Most recently with a study that we did at the Huntsman Cancer Institute that I mentioned earlier, with psilocybin for cancer patients with depression. And that study, I'm happy to say a little more about it if you'd like, but it was really looking at offering psilocybin in a group format. So instead of people getting it individually, which is has typically been the case with the recent wave of research, we did the preparation sessions as a group, and also did the dosing session as a group, and then the follow-up session. So it was really a group experience, a group dosing experience. And that was what was novel about that particular project.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know if you're talking about medications, my impression of that is always kind of, it's a very individual thing. One person is taking one pill or whatever the medications are. Can you talk a bit more about that group approach and what does that bring to the table? What is the use for that?
Yeah, so the idea behind that, well, there are a couple of reasons why we wanted to explore that. So first of all, there's quite a tradition of support groups for cancer patients. So and there have been good studies and evidence that those kinds of groups can provide benefit for people that are going through that common experience of being treated for cancer. And so we know there's some value, some benefit in having a support group environment like that. And we wanted to see if that positive benefit could be harnessed and combined with psychedelic medicine, you know, to potentially even boost the benefit. The other reason for looking at a group format is that the standard approach that's developed here with this resurgence of research is that for any individual that's getting psilocybin, let's say, as a treatment, that they have two therapists support them for both the preparation, the dosing, and the follow-up session. So it ends up being, you know, roughly 20 hours of time for each therapist. So for one patient to go through a treatment of one dose of medicine ends up occupying about, up to like 40 hours of therapist time, which becomes very challenging when you think about the possibility of scaling this and offering it not just to a handful of people in research studies, but more widely. we just don't have that many therapists around, you know, to offer that. So the other reason for seeing how much of this can be done in a group is you're able to reduce the number of therapist hours, like per patient, right? So instead of having two therapists for every patient, we did have multiple therapists involved because we had one therapist for each patient. And then I was the lead therapist with a group of four patients and four therapists. So there were still quite a few therapists involved, but it was, you know, almost half what it would have been if everybody had done that individually. So it's both a way of trying to make more efficient use of resources while not sacrificing like the value and the benefit that kind of treatment can bring.
That makes total sense. That's wonderful. Are there specific environments or patients that you have found benefit the most? So for example, patients with a specific kind of cancer or a specific type of environment for this treatment?
Yeah. So in general, kind of back to some of the history in the 50s and 60s, the model that has developed or emerged is that you have a participant that's in a very well supported environment, and there's a lot of attention to the what we call the setting, the set and the setting. So this means like the psychological kind of framework or mental attitude a person comes into the session with. Like there's a lot of focus on preparing people for the experience and then creating an environment that's welcoming and warm and not sterile and too clinical. So more like a living room than an exam room, like in a hospital. It's a challenge though, to create that when we're offering this kind of treatment, trying to find a way to integrate it into our current medical system, because most of our clinics and hospitals are pretty sterile. You know, they're not like living rooms. So in general, we try to create a welcoming, more inviting, you know, non-clinical type setting. And in the study I was involved in, up at the cancer hospital, we did our best to transform an infusion room. So the room where patients would typically get chemotherapy with all of its machines and, you know, and sterile surfaces and so forth, we tried to transform that into a warm, welcoming environment. And by covering up all the monitors and the machines with tapestries and blankets, by having everybody create their own personalized space and bringing in photos or other important kind of objects, right? And bringing in like flowers and making it welcoming. So that's one thing that I think is seems to be important is attention to this, to the setting and creating that kind of environment. The other thing I'll just make a note of that's interesting is, again, the standard approach is that people have, you know, they're really well supported by therapists, but they also listen to music and have eye shades on and are encouraged to really be inwardly focused. So in that sense, since a person's really with eye shades on for most of the session, and they're really paying more attention to their inner experience than to the external environment, you could make a case that, well, maybe the environment isn't that important if they're going more inward anyways. And I think we just don't really know for sure about that. But the standard still is that we try to create a living room like welcoming space for people to really set the tone, even though they're encouraged to go more inward during their experience with the medicine.
Sure.
If that makes sense.
It does. That makes perfect sense. Can you discuss the biological mechanisms and why psychedelics could be effective for patients receiving palliative care?
Yeah, so here I think we get into a little bit of the territory that we're still, I guess, learning about. So we know that the classic psychedelic medicines like psilocybin, like LSD, that the main mechanism of action is they work on serotonin receptors, specifically serotonin 2A receptors. They're agonists at that receptor site. They activate those receptors. Beyond that, we know that these medicines, they seem to have a lot of their impact by reducing the activity of something called the default mode network, which is this neural network in our brains that helps create our sense of self and allows us to, for example, project ourselves into the future and into the past and have this consistent sense of ourselves as like a solid, you know, entity. And these medicines seem to deactivate that, which opens up people to a much different experience of themselves in the world, and often can lead to what has been termed the mystical type experience, where people can have these experiences of feeling more of a sense of connection or even oneness with the environment, like nature or just the cosmos or life in general, and feel less like a limited, separate being and more expansive or connected to the greater whole. Those experiences can often help people feel a sense of transcendence of like our normal notions of time and space, and just to really feel again more whole and expansive, and like they're connected with something, or that they are part of something more greater than what they usually think of themselves as. So those kinds of experiences can just create openness and more flexibility. And I think for people facing mortality, or really thinking about death and dying and suffering, like it can transform that some of that fear around death and dying, because often with that those mystical type experiences, people actually go through a feeling of like dying, or like an experience of dying. Nobody actually dies physically, but people feel often like they're dying, and it's like an ego death or a death of our normal sense of self, and a sense of being part of something, like I said earlier, greater, you know, or the greater whole. And so for some people, at least, you know, their fear of death and dying can be greatly diminished in that way. So I'm talking a little bit more about subjective experiences versus like the mechanism of action, just because that's, I think, what we understand a little better at this point. And those subjective experiences do correlate with improvements in mood, reductions in anxiety, and enhanced sense of quality of life for people that have serious illness or that are, you know, facing end of life kind of distress.
Have you listened to the array of other podcasts from Pharmacy Focus? We have content for every specialty, including retail pharmacists, technicians, students, and more. In the latest episode of Pharmacy Focus, host Jill Murphy spoke with Craig Dolan of McKesson about the expanding role of health system pharmacists. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
I think I saw, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you also have worked with kind of bringing families into these environments and these treatments. What is that like, and kind of what are the benefits for the families as well as the patients?
Yeah, in terms of families in the world of palliative care, which like I said earlier, really starts at the time of diagnosis of a serious illness, getting families or loved ones, other members of a person's support team involved is really encouraged. People, you know, often feel isolated when they get that kind of a diagnosis or when they're going through that journey. And they often have to make some really difficult decisions about care and those are hard to make without support. So we encourage people to try to get their support system engaged in the process. And part of being a palliative care physician often involves having family meetings to talk about things that are just difficult to talk about, you know, for most people. So that's just part of providing good palliative care, I think, is getting family members involved in the process with people. With psychedelic medicines, I think up to this point, we've mainly just got family members involved in the way we normally would have, as just trying to harness that support system as a person's going through their experience and their process. I think one of the next steps, though, is likely to be to, have maybe research studies where we're actually offering those family members, those support team members, the medicine experience as well, so that they can really, maybe have a better sense of what their loved one is going through with the medicine experience, but also as part of their own, kind of emotional healing or coping process. Because going through cancer, for example, is really hard on the person that's going through it, but it's also really hard on the support system, on the family members. And so there's a big need there for support and relief of distress with the family members that I think these medicines also can provide. We just haven't gotten to the point where we're doing those kinds of studies yet, where we're expanding beyond just the patient themselves.
Sure. What roles could pharmacists play in this treatment, or do they have a role already?
Well, there are roles that are already being performed by pharmacists. One thing that happens when you're dealing with a Schedule I drug, which all of these psychedelics are at this point, unless we count ketamine, which is not technically a psychedelic and isn't restricted in the same way, but has some similar properties. But let's just put that aside for now. With psychedelic medicines, the classic ones, all of them are Schedule I, which means you can't offer them without a Schedule I license as part of a research study. So there are pharmacists that are involved in that process if they're in an institution where these kinds of research studies are being done. So that's not a lot of pharmacists at this point, but they play a really important role in helping helping the sites get those Schedule One licenses from the DEA. And then there are a lot of rules around how the medicine is taken care of and stored and protected, right? And so pharmacies and pharmacists have an important role to play in just being part of that chain of custody of the Schedule One drug, and then dispensing that, you know, when the time is right to get it to a patient. So they're an important part of the process. As these medicines, hopefully, you know, continue to come through the regulatory process and at some point get some kind of approval for use, like legal use for patients in the clinic setting, there will likely be REMS. I don't know how familiar with REMS or how often that comes up on your show, but I think any pharmacist will know what a REMS is. And so there will likely be a REMS program associated with these medicines. We don't know what that'll look like yet, but my guess is that, you know, pharmacists more broadly will be learning about that as it becomes more clear and these medicines get to that point. Right now, we're really talking about a relatively small number of research sites that are using these medicines. But if things continue to go in the direction they seem to be, we may be looking at much more widespread access, you know, in the coming years.
Well, speaking of that, you led right into my final question. Where do you see all of this going?
Well, my sense is that these medicines, psychedelic medicines in general, that they really do have a lot to offer, and across a variety of kinds of, let's say, mental health conditions, but they're really uniquely well suited for people that are struggling with emotional stress related to having a serious illness. And my hope is that as we learn more through the research about the benefits and the groups that might benefit the most, that if we continue to learn that, you know, cancer patients and patients with other serious illnesses are really good candidates for these medicines, that they just become part of the standard of care, so that when a person gets that devastating diagnosis of like a neurodegenerative condition like ALS or cancer or anything else that's going to be life limiting, that psychedelics become part of the discussion early on, and they aren't just some fringe kind of topic or something that's just kind of considered as one gets closer to the very end of their life, right? But that these medicines, they can enhance quality of life. They can reduce suffering and distress emotionally and mentally, and that they just become accessible and become part of the standard of care in terms of how we try to help people and their families that are going through challenging times.
Absolutely. Is there anything you want to add? Anything that I didn't think to ask about?
The only thing I might add is that as we learn more about the classic psychedelics, psilocybin, LSD, and others, that we do use ketamine, which is not a psychedelic, but like I mentioned earlier, has some psychedelic properties, psychedelic-like properties, that we're kind of using that as a model, because we can offer that in clinics now. And where I work as the chief science officer for Numinous, we're developing these clinic models using ketamine, where that'll help set the stage for being able to bring psychedelics into the real world, and to make them accessible and to scale it so that they do become more widely available, and you know, eventually even covered by insurance and that sort of thing. There's a lot of work being done right now with ketamine to try to pave the way for these other medicines that are coming down the pipeline. And part of what I'm interested in, besides the research, is really trying to create a palliative care program right now that offers ketamine and helps us fine tune and really figure out how to best offer these types of medicines to people.
Thanks for listening to Pharmacy Focus, Psychedelic Pharmacy. Tune in next month to hear about the future of psychedelic medicine.